John Daly here. You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily, and the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Save big money on your interior stains and finishes now at Menards. Provide exceptional color to your staining project with Minwax Color Series. It applies evenly and dries fast with just one coat. Get a quart of Minwax Color Series wood stain in over 240 colors. On sale now through April 12th. Visit our paint desk and let our helpful team get you everything you need for your stain project today.
Save big money at Menards.
Creation literally describes the serpent who inhabited the garden before the creation of Adam as an upright creature that stood on 2 feet and was equal to the height of a camel. So you imagine you're living in this land and you have this giant reptilian creature come up to you. And he's just able to offer you all sort of things while you're inside this sacred temple of God. In his natural temple where he walks with you on a daily basis. This reptile must have had some very convincing features. So what was the serpent doing there? Why was this reptilian in the garden?
Hello, citizen. This content creator discusses controversial topics. To properly engage in this content, an open mind is required. There's something very strange about this man. The words he says, the things he does. Is he perhaps a glitch in the system? Is he a rogue federal agent? Is he actually alive? Is he a lunatic, unhinged and on the loose? Can anyone even stop him? He is one of the internet's most mysterious men of mystery. He is a man who has seen his own death and lives life on the run, surviving out of spite and because he's not superstitious, but he is a little stitious. I'm proud to introduce your G-host, Jonathan Jigsaw.
There are some ideas that just keep showing up no matter how old the world gets. We've got these serpents and these ancient holy texts and these dragon gods that kind of lorded over these older civilizations. These hybrid reptilian rulers that are hidden behind these masks that are pulling the strings. Maybe it is quite literally humanity remembering something and us being forced to reinterpret something that we were never really supposed to have to go through in the first place. And listen, I'm one of those guys who has always thought that the reptilian idea, these reptilian aliens and whatnot, I've always just been like, this is so stupid. Like, why would you even come up with this? Like, some old guy in his basement just invented this sci-fi idea about these reptilian aliens that are taking over the planet. And then, of course, all the movies and everything, like, just really ran with it. But after I made the video a couple weeks ago about the Seraphim Angels, who are reptilian, potentially creating reptilian Nephilim, giants who had reptilian features, such as longer necks and reptilian heads, perhaps, and long claws and whatnot. And I began to, you know, ponder about how it's possible the Seraphim Angels created dinosaurs themselves, or that maybe dinosaurs were even, at one point, actually these ancient gods that are written about and talked about in these old texts. And once I started viewing the reptilian aliens through that lens, putting it up alongside those topics, I began to, you know, think to myself, maybe I should take to the Bible on this one. The book of Proverbs is primarily attributed to King Solomon, but Proverbs 30 verse 1 begins, "The word of Agur, son of Jacob, And Agar only appears in this verse. Most people seem to believe that Agar lived in the same era as Solomon. It would make sense. And we don't really know much more about him, except what we can glean from this one chapter, and that his name comes from a Hebrew word that means collector. So that's kind of cool. But in this verse, Proverbs 30, 24 through 28, he says, "Four things are small on the earth, but they are exceedingly wise. The ants are not a strong people, but they prepare their food in the summer. The rock hyraxes are not a mighty people, yet they make their houses in the rocks. The locusts have no king, yet all of them go out in ranks. The lizard you may grasp with the hands, yet it is in kings' palaces." So pay attention to the mention of lizard at the end there, because to me, at least, it is interesting. And it appears to be only one of two places that lizards are really mentioned in the Bible. Correct me if I'm wrong. And these two times, they're not mentioned with the same root word, but it appears the same tone. So first of all, he's talking about this thing being in a king's palace, which suggests an infiltration of a sacred place, right? That's just kind of common sense. It's just like a cockroach is an infiltration of your bathroom. It's the same type of, like, this thing isn't really supposed to be here, and yet it is. It's a place meant for the most important person in a kingdom, the king, and that should not involve lizards and reptiles, right? Especially since the other place that lizards are mentioned is in Leviticus 11:29 through 31. It says, "These also shall be unclean unto you among the creeping things that creep upon the earth, the weasel and the mouse and the tortoise after his kind, and the ferret and the chameleon and the lizard and the snail and the mole. These are unclean to you among all that creep. Whosoever doth touch them when they be dead shall be unclean until the even." So unclean things are known to sneak into king's palaces. And this metaphor and understanding, because remember, even if they're just speaking in metaphor here, that metaphor still comes from a real understanding of something that first turned it into a metaphor, something adjacent that was true. Riddles don't just pop out of nowhere to mean absolutely nothing. They have an answer that must be solved to get to the soft, chewy center. And I begin to ponder about this soft, chewy center and wonder at one point during my research if God even created reptiles, or if, like dinosaurs, perhaps the seraphim may have created all reptiles. I didn't figure at that time it was that much of a leap to make, especially since these creatures are unclean. These creatures appear to be the symbols of deception, but also divine power. And these people, these seraphim, seem to be pictured alongside dragons and stuff like that. That fits into the ranks of all the other times, all the other ways that reptiles have been seen as evil. The serpent in the garden, the serpents from Exodus that were eating the people until Moses rescued them with a symbol of a serpent. There's all these different ways, and I know that you know all of them too, that the serpent just is not pictured as necessarily the best creature in nature. And so I was just like, maybe that's because God didn't make them. It seems weird that God would make an unclean creature from the get-go, right? But before I get too far down that avenue, I do want to remind everyone of John 1:3, which is also essentially the same exact as Genesis 1:1 through 5, which says, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by him, and without him was not anything made that was made. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, and the light shineth in darkness, and the darkness comprehended it not." So that's the verse that I ran into while I was jumping to these conclusions that thinking God might not have made reptiles. Just because all of that might be true doesn't necessarily mean that God didn't create other reptiles. That is a side quest. So it's all still up in the air. The description of these reptiles or these lizards being unclean does seem to tell us that there are creatures here on Earth that are not meant to be friends that you meet or friends that you eat. And serpents and rats and reptiles all make this list. But as I continued to look for invisible things, things that I had never seen before, as I continued to ask the same questions that I've had for an entire lifetime, and while all of that was happening, I came across this movie, They Live, from the 80s. And I'm sure a lot of people have heard of this, but I haven't. This movie is set in Los Angeles, and it follows a working-class drifter who discovers that the ruling class are camouflaged aliens. And they don't look like reptilians, but it's the plot that is important. The fact that the ruling class are camouflaged aliens drives our main character on a quest to expose them to the world. His name is Nada. He's a homeless man seeking work. He encounters a preacher who warns him that the powerful elites have allied with mysterious beings to control humanity. Nada befriends this other guy, Frank, who invites him to stay at a shanty town near a church who's overseen by this other guy, Gilbert, who is their community leader, okay? And a hacker in this movie is interrupting television broadcasts and declaring humans are mere livestock for these entities, and essentially urging viewers to disconnect the source signal to reveal the truth. And curious, Nada follows Gilbert, this community leader, and the preacher into the church where he discovers gospel music playing, which is masking a sort of clandestine meeting involving this hacker who is hacking the television broadcasts. Nada takes this box from the church, and in this box is a pair of sunglasses. And he puts on the sunglasses, and he begins to see the world in monochrome with all sorts of subliminal messages, basically urging conformity and consumption all over the world. Like hidden in plain sight, okay? And he also notices that many people are actually bug-eyed aliens disguised as human beings. And that these creatures possess their own method of communication. But the point of why I'm telling you this is I feel like real life is a lot like this. In my NPC theory, NPCs aren't always people. NPCs are these infiltrating beings. And NPCs are these beings that come out of a long line of generations that are not human to really begin with. They may have been partially human to begin with, and they're more like humanoid non-humans that look a lot like humans. A lot of the major reptilian qualities have sort of been bred out or diminished over time. And it's gotten to the point where most people can't even tell the difference between a real person and a fake person. I believe this is the case on planet Earth. And I think personally, the reason that so many people don't have an inner dialogue is because they are NPCs. They are unfortunately part of a bloodline that has been tainted, a bloodline that has sort of decayed over time to the point where you don't have a lot of the qualities that maybe some actual human being has, who is perhaps of the line of Adam, you know, where you had this original contact with God, you had these original sciences as given to you by God, and you have something inherently within you that makes you in God's image that is different than the rest of creation. When we're looking at this movie and we're talking about how the main character puts on these glasses and he begins to see these aliens, that's kind of how I feel about NPCs, because I think that there's a lot to see that is hidden in plain sight that we're just not seeing. And part of it lately I have been thinking is this reptilian connection. I think this reptilian connection has something to do with it. And it makes sense. Reptiles are cold-blooded. Reptiles often disguise themselves. And I think a lot of what is hidden in plain sight is this weird reptilian connection, because everywhere you look you see reptile symbols. It's actually crazy when you start looking at all the different logos, at all the different symbols, at all the different mythologies, at all the different history, at all the different main characters and movies and all this type of stuff. The reptilian always seems to somehow make a scene, and he's always bad. So I think part of what we would see with these glasses, because even though this movie is probably just soft disclosure, I think it's very highly relevant to how I personally see the world and how everybody should see the world, which is everything is before you. If you can't see it, you're either not looking or you're not meant to see it, okay? But it's all right there, and we have sort of forced ourselves over generations to close our eyes and reimagine reality. And the reality that we have awoken into is one that does not recognize the serpents as perhaps the ones that have led us astray this entire time. There's a lot of talk about these serpent cults, these secret serpent societies that cared for sacred sciences, that fathered groups like the Freemasons and all of that kind of stuff. These serpent cults of Malta, these Mesopotamian priests who sort of shuttled the knowledge from the ancient days secretly underground through all of their little books and all of their little channels and all of their little secret ways. All of these things are elements of this, what appears to be some kind of seraphim intrusion into humanity's life, into humanity's story. And the literature and the mythology of ancient cultures is quite literally filled with accounts of dragons and flying serpents and other winged lizards who...
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today. Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.
Were in the earth at one point. So who then were these flying, fire-breathing creatures that seem to have coexisted with early man? Sometimes as his benefactor, but many more times as his tormentor. Perhaps they were just fabulous creatures, the product of man's fertile imagination. But on the other hand, I think it's more possible that they were the manifestation of something else, of traumatic events so disturbing and deeply rooted in his past that knowledge of their true nature has been essentially subconsciously suppressed. Quite a few civilizations of this world trace their ancestry to dragon-like lizards or flying serpents. In most cases, they are literally credited with bringing the benefits of civilization to mankind. And quite often, they describe themselves or are described as the actual creator of man, of life, of the world. Ancient man portrayed these creatures as far superior beings or even gods who could basically effortlessly move about the skies in their fiery chariots or their boats of heaven, as they've been called. Now, the earliest and the most important of cultures, the Mesopotamians, was probably founded by something very close to these serpent gods. And they call themselves, you're going to know this, the Anunnaki. These proto-Sumerians who are credited with the establishment of Western, if not world, civilization. So if you could literally trace everything back to a common bad guy that everybody could, you know, everybody could look at and be like, that's the bad guy, that's the common bad guy, it would be a lot easier to convince people that there is an evil here on the planet that has been here for thousands of years and will continue to be here as long as we let it. Because in the beginning, we were the ones who let it in. We still were in the garden, we let it in. And we let it in countless times after the garden too. And I think that one of the problems with humanity is they can't see evil. anymore. They just simply can't see it. They'll be horrible to each other. They'll be cruel. They'll commit heinous crimes upon their fellow man. They will abandon God. They will create their own gods. They will do all they can to enslave or enrich themselves. They will murder their kin. They will absolutely destroy the planet. And I think that a lot of this is because of the Nephilim interference in the beginning. I think most of it is. And as the Nephilim were on the planet, just running amok and warring and being generally evil and, you know, intermingling with man, I think that man populated the Earth as, for the most part, slave beings. I think that almost everywhere humanity went, they were kind of at the mercy of these Nephilim and these angels. They not only produced these mixed offspring, but they also used this process to conduct genetic experiments, which went wrong. This is probably what was meant when it said that these things sinned against all of the creatures of the earth, against everything, right? But clearly one of their favorite forms is reptilian. So I think this was a very trying period for mankind, because in this era, he was literally food for the gods that he chose. But all the turmoil on Earth was abruptly ended by the onset of the Great Flood. And at that time, the gods, I think, retreated to some zone. Some people like to say their spaceship, and maybe the inner Earth, maybe some sort of other dimension, and they left behind their semi-divine offspring, the Nephilim, to perish with mankind in the world flood. So the angels, the seraphim, all of the angels that interfered with mankind, they had to go back to the spirit realm in some capacity, probably. It would be interesting to know what that spirit realm looks like for fallen angels. And obviously, some probably retreated inside the earth. We know that they can be physically bound, so that, you know, some might actually physically be in the earth during the flood. I believe that a lot of Nephilim and reptilian entities sort of went into the earth, like in caves and mountaintops and all that kind of stuff, to try to survive from the Great Flood. We know they were in the earth after the flood, so clearly they didn't all get killed or they got brought back. It's generally believed that after the waters had subsided, these fallen angels descended once more to establish new cities on the plains of Mesopotamia. Some of the Nephilim came out from the inner earth, and everybody again began mating with mankind, and they produced a race of semi-divine beings to rule their empire on Earth once again. And in addition, a race of warrior gods was established in the lands of the Levant. These were descendants of the Nephilim, but known by the name of Raphaim. And this was a very barbaric race that plagued humanity for basically thousands of years, and they weren't even eliminated as a threat until the first millennium BC. But in ancient Mesopotamia, the gods resided in a temple atop a ziggurat, which looks kind of like a pyramid. Remember how I've been saying lately, I think that all of these pyramids are designed for Nephilim worship, and I think all of these pyramids, or maybe fallen angel worship, but they are, they're shaped the way they are because they look like a mountain, which is, I think, probably in some way prophetic when we think about the fallen angels descending on Mount Hermon, okay? I think it's like one of their symbols, one of their signs, one of their memories that they like to hold on to. But these ziggurats were shielded from the general public and were basically accessible only to a few trusted priests. And this is where your serpent cults would start to come into play. Because here, the gods ate in privacy. They were surrounded by curtains so that even the attending priests could not see them dine. It really does make you wonder why man wasn't allowed to see them, even in these old cultures. In the Old Testament, we see a story like this as well. During the event known as the Exodus, God lived in a tent and was never seen, and he didn't dine in public either. Specific instructions were given to Moses on how to prepare the food, and then he left it on a grill near God's quarters for his consumption whenever he was ready. Moses was told flatly by God that you can't see my face because man cannot see me and live. Man can't see his own God. Not only this, but man is also banned from creating an image of what he thought God looked like or what he thinks God looks like. Only a privileged few were allowed to even approach the fallen gods. In Mesopotamia, they were the demigods, the offspring of the mating of a god or a goddess and a human. And these formed the kind of aristocracy and were entrusted by the gods to see to their needs and to form a barrier with mankind. And even these demigods, or changelings as they were called, were somewhat strange in appearance and probably had many reptilian characteristics. According to the ancient Babylonian tradition, as reported by Berossus, who is this Babylonian priest writing in Athens in the 3rd century BC, man's ancestry and origin can literally be traced to one Oannes, who is an amphibious creature that came out of the Persian Gulf to teach the arts of civilization to man. And Berossus called them Anadoti, which translates as the repulsive ones in Greek. He also refers to them as Musoros, meaning an abomination. In this way, Babylonian tradition credits the founding of civilization to a literal creature, which they even themselves considered to be a repulsive abomination. So if the tradition had been invented, you would assume a more normal attitude would have been, sort of adopted to glorify these creatures as splendid gods or heroes. But instead, they chose to describe their ancestors as repulsive abominations. Most of the world mythologies and religions refer to their ancestors as these flying serpents or dragons who brought the arts and crafts of civilization to mankind. The oldest of Chinese books, the mysterious Yi King, claims that the ancient goddess Nukua, who was a dragon, formed the first humans. And then the oldest and most famous of the Hindu classics, the Ramayana and the Mahabharata, concern the intercourse of early man with serpent gods, who were also his ancestors. And then, of course, one of my favorite places to study the Central and South American snake gods, such as Quetzalcoatl of Aztec legend and lore. And you have the African mythology relating to how flying serpents and dragon-like beings descended from the heavens to teach them the basics of civilization. I guess you could say Satan infiltrated the garden, but it seemed like the garden was sort of an uninfiltratable place, right? Maybe it was open. Who knows? I guess maybe it was open to anybody who would like to wander through it, but you would think not because I don't know if all original man was able to see God like Adam was. I'm not exactly sure. I do think that maybe there was an element of original man that existed before Adam, perhaps. You know, day six man. Adam was, it seems, created on day eight, but that may be a misinterpretation. This is just one of the things that I'm just kind of looking at these days. Regardless, besides Adam and Eve, the other important denizen of the Garden of Eden appears to have been this serpent, which would have been a lizard. Lizard, soon to be serpent. And this serpent appears to have been given qualities which maybe even rival and surpass those of Adam. Even Genesis concedes the point when it asserts that the serpent was the shrewdest of all the wild beasts that God made. The Haggadah, which is a pretty vast reservoir of stories and legends from the oral tradition of the Jews, describes the serpent as tall, two-legged, and with superior mental powers, and he was lord over the beasts of Eden. And it says that God spoke to the serpent and said, I created you to be king over all the animals. I created you to be of upright position. Again, this is in the Haggadah, not the Bible, but it seems, according to these ancient writers, that he walked like a man. So I think we can kind of assume, just by even hearing the story in Genesis, that the biblical serpent was not some lowly snake. As a matter of fact, he wasn't a snake at all to begin with. He was some kind of lizard. I mean, God distinctly says, I'm going to take away your arms and legs. You're going to crawl around on your belly and eat dirt for the rest of your days. So if God's going to curse you in that way, it implies that you're not already that way, which is what snakes are. So this entity, this giant lizard-like being, could converse with Eve. He knew the truth about the tree of knowledge. And because of his abilities, his stature and whatnot, it seems that he was of such an appearance or manifestation that he unhesitatingly challenged God and was very convincing to Eve, this reptilian entity in the Garden of Eden, the source of the first sin. And again, the section in the Haggadah that deals with the creation literally describes the serpent who inhabited the garden before the creation of Adam as an upright creature that stood on 2 feet and was equal to the height of a camel. So you imagine you're living in this land and you have this giant reptilian creature come up to you. And he's just able to offer you all sort of things while you're inside this sacred temple of God, in his natural temple where he walks with you on a daily basis. This reptile must have had some very convincing features. So what was the serpent doing there? Why was this reptilian in the garden? Allegedly, and this is according to extracurricular texts, so take it as you will, but there's a strong suspicion that the serpent was tasked with supplying God with gold and silver and gems and pearls, which may have appeared as an obviously mundane commercial task for a group of spiritual beings, which might have been the thing that really made Satan jealous in the first place, that made these angels jealous in the first place. What the heck? We have all these abilities and we are wondrous, and yet we're collecting shiny rocks? What are we doing here? I think it's pretty noteworthy that, again, we have this preoccupation with gems, as in Genesis, which describes the products of Eden. The gold of that land is choice. There is bdellium and lapis lazuli. Isn't it always interesting? I always thought it was interesting how that detail was mentioned in the Bible. It makes you wonder why. It's also interesting to me that this entity was in the Garden of Eden at all. It's interesting that he was in the Garden of Eden at all. Now, allegedly, this is going to be before demons, right? Because there's no Nephilim yet. And if Nephilim, or if demons are the souls of fallen Nephilim, then it would be safe to say that Satan is probably the only evil entity worth talking about right now. And he's in the garden already. So let's sum this up a little bit. Preceding man and then later cohabiting the Garden of Eden with him, this serpent was also manlike in many ways. He was tall, he stood upright on 2 legs, he did all the work that was needed, particularly mining and maybe even some agricultural stuff. And above all, the serpent had an intellect superior to man. He was able to trick man and cause man to fall. These are all attributes of the Anunnaki.
Hi, Uncle Laser here. America's built on fast cars, fast food, and even faster women. Photo Casino's built in America. You know what they're fast at? Fast cash prize redemption. You see, only Moto is U.S. owned and operated. Moto, it's American made. That's who we are, and that's who we care about. Play for free at Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social.
In Genesis, the serpent was severely punished for his role in the downfall of Adam and Eve, as we all know, and his fate was henceforth to crawl on his belly. And in this way, Genesis definitely implies that at one time the serpent was not a serpent. The Haggadah is a little more explicit and just quite directly says that his hands and feet were hacked off. Interestingly enough, there's these ancient Jewish legends that indicate that the clothes that were worn by Adam and Eve were not only made of reptile skins, but that they protected them from predators, because it was said that when they wore the coats, Adam and Eve were told all creatures on earth would fear them. So the serpent skins were symbolic of the ruling race and not only reminded Adam and Eve of their origin, but also acted as a sort of talisman to protect them from wild animals, or at a minimum, a warning sign to these animals that Adam and Eve are not the same Adam and Eve that you got used to in the garden. And so you might want to take a look at a closer look at them and maybe not approach them. Now we're going to digress a little bit to the flood story. I know we've been talking about the flood off and on over the course of the past few weeks, but we're going to go back to it because there's some interesting nuggets of information in here. And according to the account of the creation of Earth in the book of Genesis, at one time it appears that the waters were all commingled together, and then they were divided. God said, "Let there be an expanse in the middle of the water to form a division between the waters," and it was so. God made the expanse, and it divided the water below it from the water above it. The separation of the waters, with half remaining on the surface of the earth and half going into the upper atmosphere, is also mentioned in the book of Jubilees. And this is one of the lost books of the Bible. It was originally written in Hebrew as an extensive sort of retelling of Genesis and Exodus, but it's not technically considered a member of Bible canon. But it's clear that just as much moisture remained in the atmosphere as was found in the world's oceans, because it says, "And on the second day he made the firmament in the midst of the water, and the waters were divided on that day. One half of them went up above, and one half of them went beneath the firmament." Clearly, it seems to be asserting that as much moisture that was held in the sky, presumably as a dense cloud cover, was also contained in the seas below. And this condition appears to be universally noted, because there's many ancient cultures referring to a time in the far past when there didn't appear to be a sun as we know it today. In the Popol Vuh, the sacred book of the ancient K'iche' Maya, it is stated that there was a time when it was cloudy and twilight upon the face of the earth. There was no sun yet to be seen, for the sky and the earth existed, but the face of the sun and the moon were covered. So there's this dense cloud cover or vapor canopy that would essentially be over the whole earth, and that would mean that blue sky was probably not seen by the ancients until after the flood. One of the oldest pieces of Sumerian mythology, if not the oldest yet known, kind of echoes the description of the Popol Vuh. It says, "The reptilians verily descend. The earth is resplendent as a well-watered garden. At the time, Enki and Eridu had not appeared. Daylight did not shine. Moonlight had not emerged." A stable cloud canopy, I want you to imagine this, also meant that the earth had to be watered by a different regime than it is today. And the book of Genesis says God had not yet sent rain upon the earth. Instead, a flow would well up from the ground and water the whole surface of the soil. So it wasn't until the cloud cover collapsed with the event known as the deluge that man actually saw sunlight and blue sky, it would seem. We can also find some more verification of this in Genesis, which states that the Lord introduced the rainbow after the flood. Rainbows, as we all know, are the result of the prismatic effect of the bending of the rays of the sun through water droplets. So rainbows can only occur after rain and require the direct action of sunlight. So if God is saying that he's going to put the rainbow in the sky as a sign for us, that would imply that the rainbow didn't exist before the promise was made, which would imply that rain didn't really happen before the promise was made. Genesis seems to assert that there was this infiltration of Nephilim twice. In the book of Jubilees, the descent of the two separate groups of angels to Mount Hermon in northern Palestine is also reported. And like I said before, the book of Jubilees kind of builds off Genesis. It's extracurricular. It's not a part of canon, but it tells the same story. And it says that a group descended in the days of Jared in the 10th Jubilee, and then later in the 25th Jubilee, during the days of Noah, another group came down to earth. And since a Jubilee is a Jubilee year is 50 regular years, this source would claim then that they descended to earth about 750 years apart from each other. So how does all of this relate to the serpents? Well, what I'm trying to show here is that there were serpents before, and that even after the flood, the serpent imagery continued. The evil that we can pinpoint pretty accurately that occurred pre-flood kind of appears to meet its end, or so you would think, at a global cataclysm. And yet afterward, we still find all of this serpent worship. Now, to sum all of this up, when we're talking about snakes and reptilians and lizards and all this kind of stuff, it's important to note that even in the ancient Greek, the word serpent posed problems in translation. And the Septuagint, which I got right here, it's this early Greek version of the Old Testament, the serpent is called drakon. And in ancient Greece, the word drakon was used for all large, fearsome creatures, like serpents, massive reptiles, and other terrifying animals. So the term drakon carried over through semantic channels to the association of these large, winged, legged serpents known as dragons in Western literature and culture. So it's not hard to see how, in all probability, the dragon and other fabulous creatures of mythology are possibly distortions or memories of these serpent gods. And this is a semantic problem that has been fostered by man's revulsion, for some reason, in linking his ancestry to an ancient spiritual realm. But then you have the Rephaim, or the warrior gods, and these are the descendants of the antediluvian Nephilim, it would seem, who later protected the Middle East, and they were these large, fearsome warriors and probably exhibited many of the characteristics of their forebears, including reptilian features. And as they intermarried with humans, their traits diminished, and throughout time, they continued to diminish until we get to where we are today, where you can't always tell if you're speaking to a reptilian. Where we have these concepts of the reptilian brain, which cause people to react instead of think, similar to how lizards or reptiles simply react because they are basically moving entirely on impulse. Whereas humans have been sort of, allegedly, the ones with dialogues, with inner dialogues or inner monologues, are able to sort of talk their way through things and problem solve and be creative and pray and all these things that an NPC can't really do or won't really do for one reason or another. So I think the question that we have is not where did they come from, because now it would appear that we know. We don't know directly where they came from, but we knew when they came from, right? The question now is, when did the serpent gods leave? Or are they still here, even now? Into these days. And I think most people who listen to this show would say, yeah, obviously they're still here. Now, here's a crazy thought that I want to leave you with before I close this episode out. The flood is a watershed in the history of mankind, right? It ended this golden age of the gods, and it was the beginning of the rule of man, finally, right? The junior gods, the lowercase g gods, they seem to have remained for some time after the flood, and they seem to have directed the activities of mankind for a while, even after the flood. Man continued to kind of be used as a tool in their family squabbles and used as slaves and sustenance and all of that kind of stuff. And of course, this continued to lead to widespread destruction all over the world. But that being said, when we think about all of these ancient civilizations that have been lost, or cities like Atlantis, places that we're told never existed, even though all these ancient texts talk about them and stuff like that, peoples that existed, you can even bring up conversations about the total destruction of Iceland or the what was going on in North America at this time. Tartaria, even. A lot of these civilizations of advanced tech that people wonder where it went. It's interesting to think about how after the flood, the millennium that followed appears to have marked the end of a great many civilizations. So if we're going to look for lost times that have occurred throughout history, this is a great place to look for it. Right after the flood, about 1,000 years after the flood. Because again, this is very close to the original sciences. This is very close because these Nephilim, these fallen ones that would have come out of the earth or come out of the other dimensions, not to mention the knowledge that Noah had or what God gave Noah in these days and all of this kind of stuff, this would have led to probably an advancement, a quick advancement in technology once again, or at least a quick setting down of technological roots once again, so that mankind can get ripping and roaring again. So if you believe that technology, that everything we have now is stuff we've already had, we've already been here to some degree, at least in some capacity, we've done something similar to what we're doing now in our past, as in the days of Noah, so shall it be when Christ returns, all this kind of stuff, then yes, in my opinion, this is one of the most realistic places that you can look for the erasure of great advanced ancient technologies. I hope this episode wasn't too much. I'm kind of like, I don't know if you guys have been noticing, but lately, these past few episodes, I've just been really brainstorming about some of the questions that I've put down over the years. Like, I'll ask myself a question and then I'll be like, no, that's not true, or that's BS, or that's just too weird or whatever. And then I'll just forget about it. But lately, I have been digging through all of these old questions that I sort of abandoned and coming to new conclusions. And I think that, you know, this serpent, this reptilian race, they've existed all this time. They existed before the flood. They existed after the flood. This episode that I was able to make today, at great cost of time, I might add, even if it doesn't seem like it.
John Daly here.
You know what day it is? Neither do I. I live life daily. That's why I only spin on Moto Casino. Moto's got daily free bonuses, daily tournaments, new slots added daily. And the best part? Guaranteed daily jackpots. You can't beat that. So today's the day you grip it and spin it with me on Moto, America's social casino. Play for free on Moto.us.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
It points to where they came from or when they came from. And I just feel like in nowadays culture, spiritual culture, it is extremely important to know where the enemy is, to know where they came from, to point out the enemy and be like, you want to know why everything feels scripted? You want to know why everything feels fake and evil? You want to know why everything is a little bit off? It's because your lizard doesn't have legs anymore, dude. Your lizard is a snake now, and he has been deceiving mankind since the dawn of it, and he's still doing it today, and they are obsessed with their image, which appears to be reptilian in nature, which definitely explains the reptilian conspiracy theory that we've got when we talk about aliens. Because we all know by now that they're going to try to paint demons and fallen angels as aliens so that we accept them, because we have to accept technology, not spirituality. You know, and I don't know if mankind is ready for the truth yet, especially when it comes to my NPC theory on these things. When we start talking about how a lot of the bloodlines have persisted and there are still Nephilim, there are still Nephilim bloodlines on the planet today, and when we're encountering all of these human-like non-humans and these NPCs, these non-player characters, these people that don't really appear to be alive, they appear to be dead a lot of the time, they don't really seem to be all there, they don't have any problem-solving abilities, they don't have any spirituality, they don't have inner monologues or dialogues, They don't have the ability to think critically, creatively, or godly in any sort of way. They just kind of react on impulse, and they just sort of do things according to their instincts and all of that kind of stuff. I don't know if the world can accept a reptilian revelation at this point, you know? I don't know if they can accept a demonic exposure beyond what they're already being exposed to, which has lulled them into such a sleep that we might never escape it until one of these days we will be shocked into accepting the truth when these things return once again to see how their playthings, us, are faring. Man has literally been conditioned for millennia to deny the truth of his ancestry, and so we have developed this convenient form of amnesia. We live in a slumber. We live in a lull. Not a faithful rest, but rather a deep, intoxicated slumber. We have accepted the interpretation of history propagated by a literal self-perpetuating priesthood and academia. Of course, the truth can only be delayed for so long, though, and eventually mankind will have to learn the truth about his origins and face the fact that these lowercase g gods and these ancestors had great reptilian features and assets, and they were truly monsters by any of our current definitions. There will be a massive cultural shock as we have never seen before. And that is why I think I might believe in reptilians. Probably more on this to come. Thanks for watching. The life is in the blood. Can we try to keep it civil in the comments, and can nobody make fun of my hat this time? Thanks.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited, no purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.